excited to introduce my friend Dave Carter this morning. Last night I was up at EB Free Fullerton talking to the late counselors there, and Dave introduced me, and I was interested to see how he was going to do that. But turn around. But turn around is fair play. So I want you to know that Dave was gracious last night. But I am so grateful for this guy. Dave is probably the, speaking of old men, he's been on the board probably longer than any other board member at this point. And Dave and I have just had many conversations about the center, about ministry, about pastoring, and how what support is needed. And I have been incredibly grateful over the years for the friendship with Dave, for the input from him, the conversations with him. And so I'm just delighted that he is here to speak with us this morning. He pastored in Michigan with Joe Stoll before he came here to EB Free Fullerton with Chuck Swindoll. He's been 23 years at EB Free now. He's written 5 books, travels the world at this point, speaking to mission organizations and church groups. And his specialty, he's a licensed marriage and family therapist. His specialty is dealing with affairs. And if you don't have, probably his classic textbook is Torn Asunder. It's a book I give to couples who have had an affair and are trying to make their marriage work. And Dave has done a lot of research, speaks at the Moody Pastors Conference often, does work with Leadership Magazine and research and writing of articles. So Dave, we are honored to have you come with us. Thank you, and share what's on your heart, brother.
I hope you don't remember my face. Seriously. It's August 1977, and I'm a youth pastor at this time, 10 years out of seminary, driving a school bus back from the East Coast on a team mission trip. I had spent the previous day, it's a Saturday, I spent the previous day with a youth pastor friend of mine who had gotten involved with a secretary in the church, and he was trying to save his marriage. And I'm sitting in this bus driving back to Ohio, thinking how, praying for him, worried about him, wishing I'd had a chance to spend more time with him. And in those days, if you have ever attended a Baptist church, you know Sunday is not a day of rest. So I get home about midnight. I'm up at 5 o'clock in the morning going to the church on Sunday, working like a dog. Finally get home about 9 o'clock that night. But in the meantime, my pastor, my senior pastor, has preached on the prodigal son. On Sunday morning, I'm thinking, oh man, I wish my friend would have been here to hear that message, etc. I get home about 9 o'clock that night. About 15 minutes later, I get a phone call from the senior pastor's wife, and she's crying hysterically on the phone. So I finally get her to calm down, and she tells me that her husband has left. So I hop back in the car, I drive over to her house. Two of her teenagers have been on that trip with me to the East Coast. I walk in this house, everybody's crying, wailing. And I finally get them calmed down enough to talk a little bit about what's going on. And as they begin to tell me a little bit about what they suspect is going on, I begin to think to myself, you know, I think I know more about this story than I realized. So about 11 o'clock, after they're finally calmed down, and I'm promising to come back in the morning, and I'm sure this is just a mistake, I drive to the neighboring town. I pull up in front of an apartment building, and I'm sitting out there. Now, this is about 11:30 at night. And I'm looking at this apartment building because in this apartment building for the last school year, I've had Bible studies every other week with the teenage boys who live in that apartment building and in that particular apartment. But I just feel like maybe something has gone on that might have to do with what my senior pastor's experienced. So I sneak out of the car and I hide behind the bushes and I kind of on my hands and knees as I crawl underneath this window and I finally sneak up and I put my face in front of this plate glass window and I look inside and there is not a stitch of furniture in that apartment. And I was just in that apartment 2 weeks earlier. So I think to myself, what happened to this family? So then I decide to come back early in the morning. I'll go to a school bus stop. Maybe I'll find some of the boys there that I've been having in the Bible study. Maybe they will know something that happened to this family, and I'll find out a little bit more of the details. So I go there the next morning. Sure enough, I see some of those boys there. I walk up to them and say, hey, what happened to such and such? Oh, they moved. What do you mean they moved? Yeah, last Saturday they moved. Really? Where'd they go? They wouldn't tell us. They just pulled up a U-Haul truck, and they were packing furniture and moving. I thought to myself, U-Haul truck. I know where a U-Haul truck store is. I get back in my car. I drive to the closest U-Haul truck store. I walk in to this truck store, and I said to this guy behind the desk, I said, my pastor has rented a truck, and I just want to make sure all the details are fine, okay? So he throws the whole sheaf of invoices at me and says, look for yourself, I'm too busy. So that was before attorneys ruined all this. So anyway, I pulled out this sheaf of invoices and I started going through them. And sure enough, I found my pastor's name on one. He was Dallas, Texas. So I called my wife. I said, I'm going to Dallas, Texas. I said, pack my suitcase. I drive home. I pick up my suitcase. I drive another 90 miles to the closest big airport. I buy a ticket. I get on a plane. I fly to Dallas, Texas. And I set up shop on the 14th floor of the Hilton Hotel overlooking the U-Haul truck store that this truck is supposed to go back to. I stay there 6 straight days, okay, with my binoculars, okay? Now I'm going to tell you something. Don't run from me, okay? Because I'll find you, okay? So I sit there for 6 straight days, and on Saturday morning, I get a phone call from the church back in Ohio, and they said, you know, the place is going crazy. You got to come home. You know, we can't have everybody gone. So I go to the airport, and before I go to the airport, I think, I got to go down and tell that guy something. So I walk down, all the way down the elevator, and walking across the street, I'm thinking, what am I going to tell this guy sitting in this U-Haul truck store? Well, I'm a Boy Scout, pastor. I mean, I have to tell the truth, okay? So I walk in to this store, and this guy's sitting behind a desk, and there's a counter across the front. And I walk up to the counter. He doesn't even look up. He says to me, he says, can I help you? I said, yeah, you can. I said, I think my senior pastor has ran off with another woman in my church, and he's bringing the U-Haul truck back to your truck store. Okay? Well, when I said that, he looks up and he puts his hands on the desk and he stands up real slowly and he looks at me and he says, I'm Southern Baptist, let's get him. Now that is the honest truth, okay? It is. So I show him this picture of my senior pastor and I give it to him and I write my name and phone number on the back of it and I leave it with him. I fly home to Ohio Monday morning, 10 o'clock. He calls me on the phone. He's whispering. And so I start to whisper too. You know what I mean? He's in my office. Are you sure it's him? Yeah, I know it's him. How do you know it's him? He's got the same shirt on in the office that he has on in the picture. I know it's him. I tell him, well, you know, God will forgive you if you have to lie. Lie, okay? Tell him you're going to send him some money. I know he'll bite at it. He's just a sucker for money. So I said, get an address. So he calls me back about 10 minutes. He has an address. So I call my wife, we pack a suitcase, I drive to the airport again, I buy another airplane ticket, and I fly to Dallas, Texas. I take a friend with me, and we get a rental car, we go to a house residence, we knock on the door, and this mom comes to the door and screams. Okay? And I thought she was going to pass out. And behind her come my senior pastor. We got him in the car, we took him to a park, we tried to persuade him to come home to his family, and he said no. He's not. So I took him back and to his house. We had a word of prayer. And when we prayed, my friend said, Dave, why don't you lead us? And I just started sobbing, uncontrollably at this experience. And so we dropped him off. We got in the car. We drove to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. And finally, as we're pulling into the rental car parking lot, I quit crying. And I look over at my friend and I say to him, when I get home, I'm going back to graduate school and I'm going to figure out why pastors do this, because this is the second senior pastor I've had and both of them ran off with other women in the church. Okay. So what you're going to hear today comes out of 30 some years of listening to these crazy stories. I am not as perverted as you think I am. Okay. I'm not. And one of the things I'm going to share with you is I've had the privilege in the 90s of being on a research team that, with permission from leadership and CT, we used their survey from the 88 and from 92 and did another survey in 93 and another in 98. And just yesterday, I got confirmation that that survey is still continuing through a fuller PhD program. With a student there, and the research will be published. It'll be 20 years on pastoral infidelity. Now, using the same survey tool. So I'm going to share with you, though, some of the details that we found in the 4,000 pastors that we surveyed up through 98. You'll find this very interesting. Okay. Then after that, we're going to go and take a look at how this seems to happen. The most shocking experience to me in all the research, the most shocking statement, the question that just, I denied it was true, I just couldn't believe it was true, was that 89% of the pastors who acknowledged that they had been sexually indiscreet while in ministry and marriage, 89% of them said that they were blindsided, they were surprised, they weren't looking for this, they were shocked when it happened, etc. Now, all the way through school, and even in my ministry period, I had always been taught to believe guys who do this, they run all the red lights, you know, they break down all the barriers, they bust out the hedges, you know, there's something perverted in their thinking. We used to screen for these kind of pastors with the MMPI on scale 4, psychopathic deviant scale. We tried to find that up there, okay? All the major seminaries used that scale for years. But these guys were telling us it happened accidentally to them, okay? Well, if you're going to look at numbers, if you're going to work in the kitchen, you know you've got to stay in the heat and figure this stuff out. So I'm going to share with you some of the outcome of this, okay? I think you'll have a good time doing it, too. Some of the surprises. 21% of the pastors admitted that they'd been sexually indiscreet while in ministry and married. 21%, 1 out of 5. Okay. This is 4,000 of them that were surveyed over 10 years in different settings. Some of those surveys were mail-out surveys. Some of them were subscribers to the magazine. Some of them were done in pastors' conferences, etc. The last question on the survey is, did you tell the truth? And 14% of them said they lied. An additional 14%. Now, there's only one thing you're going to lie about. And you might have misunderstood the question, but it's a pretty simple question. Did you tell the truth on this survey? And 14% said no. Okay? So we thought that was very, very interesting. It's just too frightening to face reality. The three of us on this research team estimated that in reality, about 40% of pastors have a sexual experience with someone other than their spouse while in ministry and married. Okay. Now that is very close to some hard numbers that have been around since the late 80s on the Christian population at large, which is basically about 40% of the Christian population will experience a sexual infidelity in their marriage before one of the spouses reaches the age of 40. That's been around since the late 80s, and that's a pretty hard number. And so pastors, pretty much in the same category as the Christian population. Now, this interesting thing is the decade of danger. We always kind of thought of this as an old man sin. The decade of danger, 49% of these sexual indiscretions took place in the years between 31 and 40. Now, some of you in here say, oh, we're out of the woods. Praise God. You know, I'm on my way home happy. I'm going to finish well. Well, 25% of them took place before 31. And I'm going to tell you why in just a second. I think that number will be way up next time we do this survey. And 25% of them, roughly, about 20% of them took place after 40. But just think of this time frame, 31 to 40. What is going on in 31 to 40 in most of these guys' lives? They have children. They have no money. They're exhausted from graduate school. They're probably in a very tough spot. They're just getting started in their ministry. They haven't got it all figured out yet. Maybe they're doing well. Maybe they're susceptible. There's all kinds of things. I'm going to tell you some of those stories as we go on in the morning's presentation here. But that's the decade of danger. That's when people really seem to have a difficult experience. These pastors reported that only 7% of their churches ever found out about their sexual indiscretion. 7%. Okay? Less than 1 out of 10 churches ever found out about it. It was a secret. Now, I don't want to tell you what that means, but that means it's a lot more frequent than any of us kind of recognize or realize it. This is an interesting one. 70% of the pastors who admitted were seminary grads. So education is not a preventive tool in this case, okay? Okay? It's just not. It just doesn't work that way. The younger the conversion age, the more likely the adultery. So guys who trusted Jesus in childhood were 3 times more likely to be sexually indiscreet in, while in ministry and married than guys who trusted Jesus after 30. Okay? Now, there's all kinds of reasons and speculations for that as you think about it. Maybe their faith didn't grow. Maybe the 30-year-old or the 35-year-old knew how crummy the world really is. Maybe the guy that trusted Jesus when he was a kid never felt like he was forgiven much. You know, maybe he's become envious about 35 or 40 and he's missed out on life, okay? Who knows all those reasons, but that's what the numbers say. The next one, 90%, almost 90% of them reported feeling shocked and blindsided by their indiscretion. Now that was the statement that got me. They were allowed to choose words to describe their experience from a list of words. And those were the two words that showed up most frequently. Okay? So that kind of leads us to an interesting conclusion. Is it possible that someone can be innocently and ignorantly prepared for adultery? Okay? That's the question. Is it possible that someone can be innocently and ignorantly prepared for adultery? They don't even recognize what's happening. They don't even see it coming. It's a setup. Well, don't forget that the power of a temptation always lies in its timing. And even when Jesus was tempted in the Gospel of Luke, it says the devil withdrew from him for a more opportune time. Okay? And there's nobody that's the master of time more than the devil himself. And so the power of a temptation really does lie in its time. You might resist it for a long time. You might resist the temptation to do any number of things. But the timing is the issue. So if timing is an issue when temptation is more powerful, what makes that timing, that particular time, so powerful? Well, we're going to talk about that today. And I'm going to share with you some things that I've learned in the process. But I'm a big fan of processing information, and I have a tendency to shoot like out of a fire hose. And so I'm going to give you about 3 or 4 minutes to talk about what I've already said. Now, if you don't like the person you're sitting next to, now's the time to move, okay? But I'm going to give you a few minutes. Just turn and talk about what you've heard so far. Go. I'll give you a couple minutes to do it. When we talk about a temptation, what's this experience like? Part of this, the research and the reading and the presentation and the study that I have done with some other people who specialize in this field, it sounds titillating probably to you and kind of exciting. It's really not. It's really not at all. There's nothing. Although I will admit there have been times I kind of wanted to see what that girlfriend looked like or that, you know, in that process. I'll tell you some more about that later on, okay? But we're talking here about a relationship. The thing that I had just been intrigued with over the years, and I started in about 94, I got myself a little black notebook, and every post-affair interview afterwards, I jot down notes in that, and how this happened. And what I'm going to share with you is kind of a compilation of some of those notes, just listening to people. And we're talking here about relationships with potential for extremely quick chemistry. We're talking about an infatuation explosion that sweeps people off their life. My first clinical supervisor ran a 30-bed alcohol rehab inpatient program. Okay. And that's where I began to learn about alcohol addiction. And in that time, back in the 80s, we would talk about this person's under the influence of a mood-altering substance. We would use that phrase. And I have been so impressed with this thought. Infatuation is a mood-altering substance. It will alter your thinking. It will raise your depression. It'll wipe out your anxiety. It's better than nicotine, and it beats Prozac every time, okay? Seriously. I'm serious. And the point is, people have a tendency to discount infatuation because we normally see it with premarital couples. We don't really see it in real life. But I want to tell you, people have given up kingdoms, murdered their spouses, killed spouses of their lovers. They've done stupid things under the influence of infatuation. Infatuation will take you down every time. It will take you down. I want to show you how it does it. So we're talking about people who are stone drunk. stone drunk. You really have to keep that in mind as you talk with these people. When they're infatuated with someone, you can argue with them. You can say it's not reality. You can say you've never changed a dirty diaper with her. You can say all that kind of stuff. It won't hold water because they're infatuated. Now, the interesting thing is, everybody in this room has been drunk with infatuation at least once in your life. That's why you married that person that you're married to today. You know what the feelings are like, okay? Everybody gets a chance, usually, there are a few that haven't, but almost everybody gets a chance to experience how infatuation can change your mood, chemically. Now, the thing that we're going to talk about now is how people begin to use infatuation in everyday life and how they can get themselves into trouble to where they're swept off their feet and they don't even see it coming. So what kind of relationships are we talking about? What kind of people do, when people find a girlfriend or a boyfriend and they're married, especially when they're a pastor and married, what do they look for? You know, that has always intrigued me. When I first started doing this recovery with pastors and missionaries back in the late 80s, early 80s, there wasn't any training out there. There wasn't anybody doing it. There wasn't anybody writing about it or anything else. So I'm a pastor, and I felt the best thing that needed to happen was forgiveness. I mean, we need to work on forgiveness. So I would often bring, you know, this is really stupid, and I would not normally tell most people this, but you're a pastor, so you understand, okay? But I would actually bring the girlfriend and the couple into my office for forgiveness. Now, I know it's really dumb, but I told you earlier, I always kind of wanted to see what this girlfriend or this boyfriend looked like, okay? I mean, why would you do this? And, you know, I begin to realize, you know, I remember one guy in particular. The girlfriend came, she was a Christian, and she must have weighed 350 pounds, and I'm thinking to myself, what do you see in this chick? I mean, what do you see? Okay, I couldn't figure it out. And I had the wife of a missionary doctor in one time. The doctor was there, the wife was there, and she'd gotten involved with a guy at a son's athletic event who was about 4 inches shorter than her, balding, and had a big beer belly. And her husband was 6'2", made lots of money, well-educated. And I'm thinking, what did you see in that person? I just couldn't believe it. And so we're going to talk about those kinds of relationships. The first one is what I call a platonic friendship. It starts out just as a normal, natural friendship. Shirley Glass wrote a great book, Not Just Friends. Shirley's not a believer, but she has a great book out on that. And unfortunately, she passed away a couple years ago from breast cancer, but that's a great book if you ever want to read a sequel to the one you're going to get today. No, I shouldn't. You didn't. I thought you'd laugh a little sooner at that. Okay. 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 So a platonic friendship. Now, I grew up in the 60s where men and women had friends, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And actually, when Woodstock was going on, I was at Word of Life Retreat Conference about less than 60 miles away. So worlds apart, though, okay? And I am not against having friends. I want to say it right up front. I am not against having friends of the opposite sex. But I want to tell you, 49% of those pastors who admitted they've been sexually indiscreet while in ministry and married said that their indiscretion occurred with a close female friend. So friendship is a factor in infidelity, in pastoral infidelity. Now, what kinds of friends? Well, when you volunteer or serve together, in fact, one of the interesting things in the research is the source of the adultery has changed dramatically in the last 10 years, or actually in the last 20 years, and that is usually a pastor got involved with someone he counseled. That's now third on the list. First on the list was a person that he ministered alongside of. That's the first. Now, it's going to be very interesting to see if that's true in this next 10 years of study that's being done at Fuller. So the interesting thing is, as you serve with somebody together,
It begins to appear that you might develop a passion for this ministry that you two share that maybe you don't share with your spouses. Maybe you both love to sing and your spouse doesn't care to sing. Or maybe you like to work with the poor and you and this woman work, pour your lives out in taking care of the poor and your spouse just doesn't get it, has no interest in doing that at all. Maybe you love teaching children and your spouse thinks most children are brats. But anyway, you build this relationship with this person around a shared ministry passion. When you share a passion with somebody that you do not share with your spouse, it is a risky prospect. It's just risky. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying it's very risky. I'm going to show you what happens to those passions in just a second. The second thing we're talking about is a dangerous partner profile. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that person because I've been so impressed as I've done this work and done these post-affair interviews when people tell me, you know, I saw that person, I saw them, and I knew I was going to have an affair with them. I knew I was. And I think, how does that happen? I actually had a woman, this is true, at our church. Don't go thinking who you might know her. Okay, Dan, don't think, okay? I had a woman in our church who met me at the church in a counseling appointment, said, I could go up on your church platform and I could point out to you every unhappily married person in your auditorium. I said, really? She said, unhappily married people send out signals. Okay. And when I want to get involved with somebody, I never choose somebody that's happily married because I do not want another rejection. I choose people who are unhappily married because they're looking for someone in a very subtle sort of way. I want to read to you a 7-page email that was composed almost all Sunday night by a friend of mine who works in ministry. He sent it to me at 4:45 a.m. and says, I've been up almost all night writing this. Now, it was 7 pages long. I'm not going to read all of it, I promise you. You don't have to worry about that. So, here's what he says. Last Wednesday evening, I conducted a 2-hour job interview with 4 people over dinner with a very attractive single 30-year-old family law attorney. He does not work in a church, obviously. And during this 2-hour job interview, I developed a strong infatuation for this woman. My feeling of attraction toward her, really my infatuation with her, was so strong that unless I can get over this quickly, we can't hire her and I'm going to have to leave the team. In the 20 years of marriages, I have never, never been tempted to have an affair. The only thing I know to do, you can tell he's not a pastor, and the only thing I know to do is run like hell, okay? Because my attraction towards this woman is so strong that after this 1 2-hour meeting, I just feel lost. I feel like I love her, that I want to marry her and have children with her. And that is really weird because I barely know her. And because I have never wanted children before. I found myself yesterday thinking, well, if we have children right away, I'll be 70 when they graduate from high school. Am I freaking crazy or what? Okay. Now that's what he says on the first page. Okay. He didn't go looking. He didn't go seeing what this lady was like. He just got bushwhacked. And as we've been corresponding back and forth by email, he tells me a little bit later on, he says, I think I'm beginning to realize where this infatuation came from. I'll talk to you about that in just a second. But they always have causes. They are not random. No affair is chaotic. It always has contributing factors. It's very rational, even if it appears irrational to you. And there is a template of a person who matches your life history, your personality style that you admire, the void you bring from your family of origin. Remember the fat, balding old man? This woman never had a father. And he was very fatherly to her. And a great mentor. Maybe it's got a little bit of mix in there of your teenage adolescence or adolescent idols that you remember looking at. It's got all kinds. It's not a person. Don't think of Susie or Tom. It's a template. Everybody in this room has a template that you are especially susceptible to. And there's one more source. Okay? One more source. And that is this. Old girlfriends, old boyfriends. Okay? I just joined this week a website group of therapists and researchers who are interested in exploring how Facebook ruins marriages.
Wow.
Okay? That's what we're going to do. Okay? Now, I want to tell you about this. The danger in old girlfriends and boyfriends is this. Okay? I'm going to give you a scenario. You're up. It's 11 o'clock at midnight. Maybe midnight. You finally got your little baby to calm down and go to sleep. You're so wired, you can't sleep. So you sit down at the computer. You're not sure where to go. And all of a sudden, your mind goes back to an old girlfriend, old boyfriend in high school or college, when times were simpler and life was easier. Okay? So you decide to look them up. Okay? And so you do. And lo and behold, they respond to you. And you begin to chat back and forth. We have a little saying. Those of us that work in the field of adultery have a little saying. If you stay in touch with this old girlfriend or old boyfriend for 30 days, you will become infatuated with them. And you will become mentally confused about staying in your marriage. If you stay in touch with them for another 30 days, you will be in bed with them. It's 0 to 60. And you're sleeping. Okay? And why is that true? Because the infatuation for this old girlfriend or old boyfriend is stored in your brain. You don't have to create it. You don't have to grow it. It's stored there. You never forget adolescent music, adolescent cars, adolescent sporting experiences, adolescent girlfriends, adolescent boyfriends. You never forget them. And unless you were highly promiscuous, you can actually name every person you've kissed passionately. Okay. It's stored. And they trigger it. And you're swept off your feet. Now, before we go on, I want you to turn and talk. I'm going to give you 3 or 4 minutes, okay? Now, some of you will be afraid to talk about this one. What I'm going to share with you, I want to say something about attraction. Everybody in here, including myself, will be attracted to people other than our spouses in this community, in this world. This world where men and women work together, they work out together, they minister together, they do all kinds of things together. My wife's a public school teacher. We put kids in groups and they move all the way. My graduate school program was, I was in a cohort of 20 people, at 4 actually within this cohort of 20. We lived, slept, died just about going through that program together. But you just do everything together. You will feel attracted. However, some of you might be so close to death and in denial that you don't actually feel it. Okay? You just don't feel it. But what happens if you do feel this attraction? I'm going to share with you 19 stages or steps. They're not even sequential steps. Characteristics would be a better word that I have written down over 25 years of listening to post-affair interviews. And I would lay money. I'm not a rich man, but I would lay a lot of money on the fact that everybody in this room has done some of those things. Okay? So here we go. Ready? Close call friendships. Close call friendships become activated and strengthened when you begin to save topics of conversation for this person because you say to yourself, they understand me, they like this topic, my spouse doesn't like this issue, she won't talk about it, he hates this kind of thing. So you find yourself clipping articles, saving email, saving things off the internet. You know what? Susie will like this because we like this kind of stuff together. We share this together. And I want to say again, there's nothing sinful about most of these. It's the cumulative effect over a long period of time that makes them so risky. But you save topics of conversation. You might even share spousal difficulties with this person of the opposite sex because, and under the guise, you know, I just don't understand women, or my husband doesn't get it, or tell me how men think, or all of that. But what you're really subtly doing is criticizing your spouse. And this is really common. In fact, you need to remember that anybody under the age of 35 who followed Friends, the sitcom Friends, their language and their conversation and topics of conversation are way different than people in my generation. They will talk about anything that goes on in marriage. We see this in our own adult children. I have four adult children from 30 to 40 years of age married. They'll talk about anything. And friends change forever the topics that people will discuss in public with other friends. You share spousal difficulties. Maybe this friend shares some relationship difficulties with you. And so you kind of become a surrogate counselor or just a good listening ear. Just a person that takes care. You're just showing care to this person. You might actually even begin to anticipate seeing your friend more than seeing your spouse. And you know, that's very easy to do. You see your spouse at the worst possible times of the day. You know, when you're getting up in the morning, you roll over, you're stinky, you haven't had a shower yet, you know. You got to get up, you got to get people dressed, out the door on time, fix some breakfast. And then you get dressed and you go to work and you look great and you feel good. And you come home and you start the whole routine all over again. It's very easy to anticipate seeing this friend more than seeing in your spouse, because the spouse represents second shift, more work. Okay, it's just not a fun experience. You compare the spouse to your friend, you'll say things to yourself like, gosh, if Bill was more like him, our marriage would be so much more fun. Or I wish, my wife would be like Susie or whatever the case is. And by the way, I got to tell you, I'll say Susie in here a lot of time because Susie was my girlfriend as a junior in high school. And my wife, she just comes to mind. And my wife always gets mad at me when I refer to Susie. But she's not here today. So, and she knows that. So it's just a name, okay? You guys ought to be therapists. You might even provide special treats for this friend. You might even say to yourself, well, you're at Starbucks getting a cup of coffee. She likes this kind of latte. I'll just kind of get this. Maybe you get a breath mint or two or whatever the case is. You'll just buy little special treats. And maybe you're just buying something as a thank you for their contribution to what you do. It's very easy to do this kind of stuff. There's nothing sinful or wicked about it. Your heart motivation is great. You might even become more concerned about this friend than your spouse. If your wife develops a cold, you don't go blow her nose or hand her a Kleenex. You get your fanny and gear. We got work to do. We got to get kids out the door. We got to... So you just don't show the care to spouses like you do to a friend. I know. I've seen that happen right in front of my eyes. People who can be very caring to people they don't really know very well, but they just seem more concerned about them. You might even fantasize about marriage with this friend and thinking what it would be like and saying to yourself, oh, Bill is such a lucky guy to have a wife like that. And you just fantasize about what it would be like if you were married to that person. Maybe nothing sexual, maybe nothing inappropriate. Still this kind of stuff you hide. You don't want to go around talking about it. It's very easy in this culture to spend more alone time with your friend than it is with your spouse. Let's say, for instance, and we'll cover this later when we get to the line, but maybe you belong on a worship team. You might spend more alone time, hour-wise, minute-wise, with this person practicing, doing something you both love doing, than you spend with your spouse in the course of a week, doing things you two love doing. It is very easy to do. Maybe you work out at a gym, and your wife's idea of gym workouts are sitting on the couch and moving food from the lap to the mouth or something like that. They just don't care for that kind of stuff. Maybe you like outdoors. Maybe you're on a hiking. We have a hiking club at our church. We have a biking club at our church. Maybe you're a part of that. And you're out hiking or you're out biking. It's very easy to spend more alone time with that person than you spend with your spouse doing something you both deeply enjoy doing. Your spouse does not have access to all your conversations anymore. They just don't. You can have all kinds of secret conversations. And you can hide those conversations very easily. And you might start to hide them because you're afraid of what your spouse would think if they found them. You might spend money on this person without their awareness. Maybe they're a single mom and they got little kids and you feel very sad that there's nobody to show her something on her birthday or maybe on Mother's Day or whatever. So maybe even out of the goodness of your heart, you say, here's $10. Go get yourself a little treat. Or here's a Starbucks card. Or you might even give her money. But you don't tell your spouse. Because that would be neon red lights. I mean, she would be upset about that. You might even have some conflict with the spouse over the relationship. You might hear your spouse say to you, you know what, I can tell she's got eyes for you, or, you know, he's hitting on you, or, you know, you got to be careful here, and, oh, they're just friends, you know. And so you have this kind of ongoing discussion that can be conflictual at times about this person. You might even lie to your spouse to spend time with this friend. It's very easy to do. Let's say rehearsal starts at 7 o'clock, and you say, I got to be there at 6:30, or it goes to 9:30, and it really doesn't. But you want that extra half hour to do something with this friend, maybe go get a cup of coffee, maybe review the music, maybe prepare next week's Sunday school lesson, maybe do an evaluation how it went today, all that kind of stuff. But you don't tell your spouse you're spending time with that friend. You lie about it and say, this is how long the rehearsal lasts, this is how long all of us meet together, etc. So you're lying. You might hide interactions with this friend from your spouse by saying to your friend, when you see me at church tomorrow, don't look at me. Don't smile. Don't say hi. Nothing. My wife is watching. Okay? Or my husband's watching. So you start hiding the level of interaction that you have with this person out of fear of what's going to happen when you get home after church that day. You might even accuse your spouse of jealousy. Jealousy is the big gun in this situation. And you just say to him, oh, you're jealous. You're just jealous. Of course, this shuts him right up. Who wants to be called jealous? Especially in our kind of environment. Now, something happens at this point, though, that changes this whole relationship. It's a very simple thing. It's a Christian thing. But it changes the whole friendship. And this, something that happens is a touch. I want to show you, I want to say one more, develop special rituals, you have coffee together, etc. I want to show you something. Just a sec. Well, you know what, I'm going to go back. Let's do this. I thought that was the end of it, but it's not. You develop special rituals with this friend, maybe you meet at the water cooler, maybe you have coffee, maybe you all, before you go teach a class, you'll have a cup of Starbucks together, whatever the case, you develop these little special rituals. Rituals are very easy to develop with this person. There might even be sexual content in the conversations, like I said earlier, because I think younger adults talk about this kind of stuff very openly. And the other thing I think that happens lots of times in our culture is that companies will send people on traveling trips together. They will give them these unlimited business accounts to spend money on. They eat meals they can never afford to spend with their spouse. They go to entertainment venues they could never afford to go with their spouse. They can drink all the alcohol they want. They go back to the same hotel. I call it corporate dating. And it has all the components of a date. All of it. Except you just don't go to the same bed. Well, hopefully. Okay? But I want to talk about what happens in this chart. At the bottom on the left-hand side, this friend of yours, out of care for you, reaches over and touches you in a non-sexual way. Maybe just touches your arm. Maybe lays a hand on your shoulder. And you have an emotionally charged reaction to it. You shiver. You feel shocked. It makes such an impression that you think about as you walk away from the contact. There's nothing sexual, nothing evil, nothing sinful. It was done out of a pure heart, maybe. But it affects you emotionally, just like that. And you think about it, and you begin to reflect on it. And it becomes obsessive, and you lay awake at night looking at the ceiling, thinking about that touch. And you can't get it out of your mind. Your productivity at work goes down because you begin to think about it. It changes your mood as you reflect on that touch. And you actually will move to the place where you will become embarrassed to tell anybody about it because this attraction is so powerful. This email is an illustration of what I'm talking about. This guy knows he's crazy. And he's only met this woman 2 hours. Okay? And they're in a Christian ministry. And she's a believer. Okay? The point is, you become too afraid to talk about it because it is so powerful. If you don't run, like he says, run like hell. If you don't run, you will fall. You will be swept off your feet. I have never met an affair. They might exist. but I've never met an affair that didn't have this component of infatuation and fun. Fun from the infatuation. I've never met anybody who had an affair because somebody's a hard worker. Okay? I never met anybody that had an affair because someone did something really well. No, it's the emotional attraction, the infatuation that triggers it. Now, this little chart, and the previous situation, I'm going to give you about 3 or 4 minutes to talk about it, and then we're going to hurry to the conclusion. I want you to process this, though. Go. I'll let you talk a couple minutes about it. It happens in the West. Well, in the past year, I've spent 2.5 weeks in Rwanda working with the Rwandan pastors. I shared this chart. They said perfect. I've been in Singapore in November for 2 weeks training pastors. They said perfect. Okay. I was in Poland for a week and a half last year working with pastors and missionaries. They said perfect through a translator. Okay. The point is, it's worldwide. There isn't nothing unique about this. This is the way it works. Males and females. This is the way it happens. Okay. Now, let's take a look, though, at this dangerous partner profile. Who is this person out there that could just really sweep you off your feet? Now, this is a work in progress. It's not done. There are some great research studies going on right now that we'll know more about this in a couple of years. But right now, this is what we do know. This is what we suspect, anyway. I'll put it that way. First of all, everybody in this room has an internal age. It might be very different than your chronological age, which just goes on forever. Your internal age fluctuates according to the people who you happen to be around. Some of you feel like little children when you're around your parents. We've all seen 5-year-olds run families very effectively, okay? We'll have wives often talk about things like this. I have 4 children, 3 of them are under 10, and 1's 38, okay? Now, the point is, that's internal age we're talking about. And that person is different on the inside than they are externally. Affairs always match internal age. Okay? Very interesting. Developmental lag. Some people never grow up. We've all seen people who have shirts unbuttoned to their belly button with gold chains hanging out. We've seen 50-year-old women wear teenage clothes, you know, trying to... They just never quite grow. We see people who have poor work histories, who never really developed. We know that adolescent drug use and alcohol use and abuse can delay that process of normal development. And these people are just behind in the process. And as a result, they often act just like that. They never grew up. They never took on responsibility. They don't really seem to have, and this is really interesting, they don't really seem to have the capability to be monogamous. And they get into serial sexual relationships or serial marriages. Or these relationships develop to a certain point, then they break up and they start over again. We see lots of those kinds of things going on in people's lives. There's a personality style that you might really like or admire, but maybe it's a little too threatening to you. Maybe you grew up in an engineer family's home where everything was very steady, quiet, calm, predictable, and you always wanted a little more chaos than that. So maybe you dated somebody on a Harley in college or something like that, but that was just a little too threatening to marry because you're not sure how to interact with that. So you choose an engineer or a pastor, okay? So the personality style that you're... But you admire the other personality style. It has intrigued you. Hobbies and interests have a tendency to really build bonding very quickly with people. A shared hobby or a shared interest. We've talked a lot about it. Maybe you have a different kind of an attachment pattern. Now, one of the guys I worked with for a long time, his wife called me up one day and said, "My husband's living with a prostitute in Central America. I want you to call him and get him home to work on our marriage." Okay? Sure, I'll do that every day. So I call this guy in Central America who's living with this prostitute, and he comes home. Okay? And we talk, okay? And make a long story short, they put their marriage back together. And so I asked him one day, I said to him, "Well, why did you do this?" And he said, "Well, I made a list of all the people that I'd given money to in my life." He's very, very wealthy. People that I bought homes for, cars for, paid for educations for, paid for medical bills for, bailed them out of jail, whatever the case. He made a whole list of them. He said, "I made a list of 50 people. And I finally said, I'm sick and tired of taking care of everybody. I'm going to go find somebody to take care of me." And he did. Okay? He wanted somebody to take care of him. And sometimes we get involved in certain attachment ways, working hard, doing things, and it's not really what we need. It doesn't really help the attachment. Maybe you grew up in a family that had a lot of contact and hugs and kisses, and you married a wife who's stone cold, and you yearn for it. I'm not picking on anybody, okay? And if you do like that, that's your fault, okay? So there's just a difference in attachment patterns. There's family of origin deficits. We all come to a marriage with family of origin deficits, things we didn't get. Maybe especially if you were in a blended or a single parent family, it's even more pronounced. So, and there's marital voids. Now, I'm going to tell you a little thing, just be real self-disclosing so that you don't think I'm really great. We have a marital void, an emptiness in our marriage. Okay, now my wife, she loves to dance. Okay? We grew up in Baptist churches where you didn't dance. But my wife was born to dance. She's just got rhythm coming out of her ears. So we've been blessed to go on a number of cruises. So on every cruise, for years, we take dancing lessons. And I can't dance. I just got so I dreaded going on the boat. It's like, I'm going to go to prison. I'm going to go to school. I just hate this. And I finally, after six different ships of learning how to dance, I said, I'm not doing this anymore, okay? If you want to dance, honey, you know, wait till I die. Don't poison me, but wait till I die and you can dance in the next life, because I can't do it, okay? So, and she misses that. She would love to do that, but that's not going to be with me. And I'll tell you this, I am not going to send her to some dance studio, okay? So, the pursuit pattern, we've talked a little bit about this. So a dangerous partner profile incorporates these kinds of components. It'll be very interesting for you in the book. You can look all that stuff up and kind of figure out. We've talked about the old girlfriend, boyfriend, classmates.com, Facebook. Huge issues. They're the internet sites from hell. Reunions, you know, Hollywood makes movies on this. Same time next year, you know, all that kind of stuff. Professional conferences like this. No, I mean, we wouldn't do that. Okay. So, but the thing is, even though we have all these dynamics going on, what sets this off? Okay? What sets this off? Well, my friend who emailed me last week, actually on Monday morning, I said, well, you know, you need to figure out what's causing this, not just the person. There's something else involved in this. And I said, you need to start with last week where the interview was, and you need to go back for 2 years. And you will find what caused this. And he said, really? I said, yeah. And here it is. It's very simple. It's something I just learned by listening. If you go through a period of sustained stress of 2 years, you are much more likely to commit adultery. I'm going to tell you what kind of sustained stress I'm talking about. I'm not talking about raising kids or not that kind of stuff, the normal stress we have. I'm talking about unusual stress for which you have little or no preparation to handle, such as legal issues. The only people that have any kind of experience with legal issues are attorneys. That's why we dislike them so much. We don't know how to handle that kind of career-threatening experiences where your company downsizes, or you get laid off, or you get cut back on a job, or your company gets bought out, and your job's just about ending. Financial issues where you have run out of money and you're going to lose your house. You don't have enough money to live on. And you are just out of gas financially. You have no options. Health diagnoses or changes in your health that will impact the way you live, even if they're not terminal. Health diagnoses with your children or your spouse. Those kinds of highly unusual stresses over which or with which you have very little experience or how to help. Relationship changes. An adolescent teenager who's driving you crazy. A child that develops a chronic illness. Those kinds of things will set you up for this kind of infatuation. So I emailed my friend back. I told him this. I sent this slide to him. He emails me back right away and he says, you won't believe this. About a year and a half ago, we took our entire investment account, my wife and I, and we put it into some apartment buildings that we thought would be our retirement, our livelihood. And To this day, we have lost every dime we put into it. And he said, I have done everything to try to get those out of bankruptcy. I'm out of gas. In walks this cutie into a business meeting, and he goes head over heels. This stress is the issue. Because you want relief. You want to feel good. You want to get over this drain and this depression and this anxiety. It looks like this. Sustained stress creates an infatuation explosion that comes from one of these three sources, and you will be in a really deep, close call. That's the way it works. Okay. Now, in this culture, if you're a prophet, you're going to predict adultery is going rampant now and for the next 3 or 4 years. Because this is one of those kinds of cultures. And I don't want anybody, don't send me any emails, but when women get anxious and depressed, they eat. And when men get anxious and depressed, they act out sexually. Because sex is the most nurturing form of care males can know. And do you know why we know that's true? We found out 5 years ago that when a woman nurses her baby, after that delivery, oxytocin spikes in her. You can draw blood, measure. That's the highest oxytocin level she will have. And that's the bonding hormone. That's why God designed that to work like that. But in guys spike in oxytocin levels only when they have sex with someone they feel cares for them. Masturbation and sex with a prostitute will not spike oxytocin. But if you find someone that you feel really cares for you and you have sex with them, your oxytocin will spike. Now listen closely to this. 59% of all the pastoral infidelities occurred in 1 2-year period. The 9 months of pregnancy and the first year after delivery. And here is a wife who is feeling closely connected with this little baby, and here is an isolated husband who's never been through this before. Did anybody ever tell you that in a premarital class?
No way.
Okay, no way. Yeah. But University Health Centers actually did those experiments and demonstrated that for us. So there is a biochemical reason why people act out. There is a biochemical reason for it. It's not just the devil's temptation. But remember, the power of a temptation lies in its timing. Now, I'm done. And I don't know if we have any time for questions. It's 11:30 on the button. Jim, what do you want to do? I can stick around.
Okay.
Thank you.
In the prayer when we began that our goal is to help you finish well. And I don't know about you, I would assume it's true for you, but it's also been true for me as I sat here listening to Dave. I'm scrolling through the people that have been in my office just recently. And this is not a pastor that have been in my office recently. And this is not just some theoretical thing, something that's interesting. All of us are vulnerable. And our prayer is that you will finish well, and you will recognize some of these signs, and you will realize, by God's grace, I can finish well. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not careful, if I get casual and sloppy in my approach to ministry, I'm vulnerable. So thank you, Dave, for sharing this, and you will receive a book as you leave. But our prayer is that you'll take this seriously, that you will serve God well, and you'll resist anything, the timing of Satan. You'll recognize it and see it for what it is and run with everything you have. As we finish, we're handing out the evaluation cards right now. We're going to give you some time to just complete those. There's some new questions on there. So please take some time to reflect and think on those and answer them. And then as you leave, hand them in and we'll give you a book with the flyer for the couples retreat. Let me pray for you before we start to fill those out. Father, thank you for the gift of relationships. Thank you for the gift of marriage, for the gift of sex. And Lord, our desire is to have lives that are sanctified, set apart for you. And these areas that are gifts from you, Satan loves to use to destroy. And so would you protect each one of us? Help us to keep our eyes on you and to live in a life that's worthy of the calling that you have given to us, knowing full well that when we go down, others go down with us. So thank you for this challenge this morning. Would you bless and protect Dave, even mm-hmm. in this area of study and research?
Yes.
And would you continue to help each one of us in our ministries serve you well and serve you faithfully? Thank you in Jesus' name.
Amen. Amen.